Hello and welcome to another edition of Indiepocalypse Radio. I'm your host again, Andrew. I'm nailing all of my live announcements so that the three people across six platforms all see that, hey, look at this, radio show is now live. We are here as we are every Saturday afternoon, generally speaking, talking around with game developers, general people within the art space. Oh, I got to get an intro. Last week, I think I was feeling it. I think I was feeling it in terms of hosting and like getting on an intro. But now I lost the thread, but I think I got it again. I'm Andrew. I'm your host of Indiepocalypse Radio. Indiepocalypse being, of course, the monthly anthology of alternative games. I think I was dipping into underground last week. I might swing back towards underground as my term of favor. None of it really means anything. Whatever word to you means, these are not the video games that you think about when you log on to Game Pass or you watch your announcement live stream sort of things. This is the stuff that's a good safe distance away from Jeff Keighley at all times and is safe from his grasp. That's what Indiepocalypse is, perhaps. Now, we are here with our first guest, who you may know from issue 29 of Indiepocalypse, with Talking to My Dad. It's a team. Team, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a nice, cool, you know, we're getting towards the middle of November, so it's like, oh, it's starting to get chilly, which is the cruel reality of the northeast of the United States for me now. I'm looking forward to March coming around and going, huh, wasn't it supposed to get cold at some point?
Yeah.
But that's beside the point. Welcome to the show. We have, you know, I should do timer. This is the thing I'm trying to remember to do so I don't go far too over time. But everything wants to politely auto-correct and be like, oh, don't you mean Timer Interval, this band that you listen to on Bandcamp or something? Anyway, important question out of the gate. I got to know, if you remember, over almost 20 months ago, well over a year ago, how did you hear about Indiepocalypse?
I think I saw it on Twitter. I think one of the creators I follow shared that their game was on Indiepocalypse, and yeah, I just looked into it, played some games. Yeah.
Perfect, perfect. Now, speaking of playing some games, people are unfamiliar with it. Tell me about your game. Tell me about Talking to My Dad.
Yeah, Talking to My Dad is a semi-autobiographical visual novel about my relationship with my dad. So you play as me, and you are in the car with my dad, and you're having a conversation while he's driving.
Yeah. The kind of the perennial place to have conversations with a father in a car.
Yeah.
Where you're both trapped and simply forced to
exactly
speak.
Yeah.
It's a prep. As games follow their increasing datification, I think we need to tap more into the true artistic tradition that games have been lacking of games that in which we have problems with our dads.
Yeah.
Complicated relationships with our fathers, which I feel like is at the core of all art. Or generations of art.
That's what art is all about.
Yes, it's like there's a number of things that go, oh, that person just has issues with their dad.
Yeah.
But, what is this? Well, that's not the only game you made. What brought you to, making games?
I Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to make comics when I grew up.
Yeah.
And then I realized that wasn't very realistic. So I was like, oh, I should do something more lucrative, like making indie games.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but I guess I'm like into a lot of different kinds of art making. Like I like drawing, programming, music. Yeah. And I like games because it's a bit of everything.
Right, right. Because yeah. you can carry a lot of like comic language over to games as well.
Yeah.
Like I for a time, my previous thing before I kind of mostly stopped making games and started making this involved thinking like, it's very low res, but what if I did like comic style, like cutaway, like close ups for like important actions? It's like, oh, I could just do that. Because comic artists, they draw a lot of panels in order to make comics. Why couldn't I just do some of that for games?
Yeah, comics are basically just games, but yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that is a it is a weird space, you know, joking about which is more lucrative. But like I feel like games probably have a higher top end, but at the low end, like your average, like this is something I think about a lot. Like there are a lot of like different comic conventions and zine fairs that can go if you make comics.
Yeah.
But not many equivalents if you're making the same scale of indie games, you know. Like you can't really.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Like where would you bring like games that you've made to, you know, to sell, you know, and people would buy them.
Oh. I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. that wasn't like a there's an answer to the question. It is like there is not really much of one.
Yeah, for sure.
So that it creates kind of like it's a space where indie, I think, in this part of my escape from that word is that I think there was a time where indie became kind of merged with this idea that it could just be done by one person. Like, oh, this is one person making and releasing a game on their own. And I think that's still true. But obviously, because any person can make, you know, someone can make a piece of art across the course of the show from start to finish. But the indie, as it's known within games, I think it's always been sort of there's been budgets in there that you didn't see, or like 10 years of work that you didn't see.
Yeah.
Allow for one, if it's really one person, to make a game.
Yeah. Have you ever tried to sell the Indiepocalypse tapes in a physical space?
Not Ed, like I've been thinking about that more recently in terms of like, how is there someone I could say, hey, you run a store, would you stock this in there in your store?
Yeah.
But I don't know where to start with that. But I do sell it fairly regularly, like when I go to like next week I'm doing some event, some like game event by like an IGDA chapter near me, I think. But the week following that I'm going to like a regular art market kind of thing where I bring it and sell it, and it does fairly well. Like I just had to order my fourth batch of like USB sticks and cassette cases yesterday. I realized I was running low again. And I've only had to order one collection of like the boxes to ship it out, so that means like I've sold about 150 of these things, approximately.
Nice.
And about 100 of them were sold, like, in me selling them in person. So there's definitely, like a space for it, but I don't really have... I think I had two game shops nearby me, and they both shut down. Like, those kind of, like, general game comic shop kind of things.
Yeah.
But I also like do not live in a city, so like that's like the two of them. It's not really a that I had, and more than one was surprising.
Mm-hmm.
But I could probably find some way to be like, hey, game shop, do you want to sell this? Because it's a neat like form factor, you know, I think.
Yeah.
The little like cassette cases. And plenty of places do sell like zines, you know.
Yeah, for sure. People used to do that like back in the day. They used to make their own games and just sell them in game shops before like the Nintendo Seal of Quality.
Right, right. There's like, you know, I think you could follow any of the like really long-standing PC like developers, like, you know, I'm sure if you even trail back Epic's history, you'll find people mailing floppy disks, you know.
Yeah.
Like have postings online and say, if you want a copy of ZZT,
yeah,
mail money to this address and I'll send you one.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I do now. I mean, I've got a cleaner looking storefront and I've got cash, and people aren't mailing me cash, but it is the same kind of the same spirit of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, a lot of people can still do that. That's why I often encourage people to use this kind of like tape format, because it's very affordable. Like like all told, it costs like $80 for $80 to $90 maybe for 50 of them, and that's like because I use 8 gig drives. If you were like putting a game on a smaller drive, it would cost probably like $20 or $30 less than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're talking like, you know, to get too much into the math of things, that's, you know, they're only like, I'm trying not to accidentally stop my, that's like a little under $2 per, like, game to make, which if you're not splitting your sales 11 ways, it's kind of easy for, it's like very, very affordable for one person to do.
Yeah,
like even selling something for like $5, you're making like good bank off of that, I say, as if it's lucrative in any way. But it is not. It's very. But that's. I think that's the thing is like maybe the game industry, as it were, is too heavily focused on like the career developer, I guess, when that's like not realistic for like most independent artists in like every medium.
Yeah.
You know the. You know, how many other artists and comic artists and musicians have day jobs, you know, even when you think they would be quote unquote successful, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And we just had a million stories of actors who are like, you know, I'm on an extremely famous TV show and I still work day jobs, because I mean, that's another issue compounded on top of that. They just don't get paid very well because they're like, oh, it's streaming now, so we pay you a lot less.
Yeah, I mean, even in the art world, like,
yeah,
there are some alternative ways for indie developers to make their games, like if you apply to an artist grant, for example, or like an artist residency, but it's very rare that in their list of like things that they're looking for, they would include a game.
Yes. No, I've looked around multiple times, and
yeah,
I check every so often, and there's very, at least within the U.S., that's like,
yeah,
the curse of the U.S. It's like Oh, well, we already have all culture, so we're not paying people to promote. The government doesn't want to pay people to make United States culture because the U.S. exports culture. It's what it does.
Yeah.
It already makes tons of it.
Yeah, so every time I've tried to apply for Nazis grants, it's like, oh, I'm applying, but I don't know if they actually consider games to be art, so right. We never know.
I think that's like one of those things where it's like, wait 20 years. Because it's slowly changing. I don't know what people are like on the internet because I can't see them. They're like little avatars. But in person, there is like this specific like maybe college age person that seems like more clued into Indiepocalypse is cool. They just kind of they get it a lot faster, you know?
Yeah.
Where I feel like people who are older and maybe, you know, people who like quote unquote grew up with games are like harder to like convince of like what it is. But because I think it's a generation who grew up where games have always existed. It's easier to accept games as art where like, you know, it'd be weird if you thought movies weren't art.
Yeah.
But because they didn't grow up in that same like games as toys generation, even though they are still kind of like there, it does kind of have a lot of that. But you know, you growing up playing games where itch has always existed, you know.
Yeah,
it's a different.
But now we have Roblox.
Right. Yes. Of course, Roblox. this generation's StarCraft map editor, or you know, WADs. With a more predatory, closed off system.
Yeah.
There's something not to be back in the days, but there's something to be said for like a map editor that doesn't try to monetize you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But also going back to what you were saying about games being very career oriented.
Yeah.
I'm doing a master's in game design right now at NYU. And when I was doing my research for like grad programs, it's like they're all very career oriented. They're like 3D modeling for games or game programming or whatever.
Right.
The NYU Game Center was like one of the only programs that was actually a Master of Fine Arts.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, that seems to be given the types of games I get from NYU students. That seems to be the case. That is more of an art, a more arch focused course.
Yeah. Yeah, but even also like the interesting thing is that so I'm an international student here in the US, and after I finish my studies, I can apply for an OPT, which is an authorization to remain in the US and work here, which is normally 1 year. But if you're doing a STEM program, it's for 3 years. And like our program is technically considered STEM, even though it's a fine arts program.
Weird. That is like a perfect example of like people don't know what to do with games, you know?
Yeah.
They don't know how to view them or classify what they are.
Yeah. Like I'm glad that I can take advantage of that. But it's like, I'm not a STEM guy.
Yeah. No, a lot of people are not. A lot of game developers are not STEM people, especially within like the indie or space. But then also like a ton are like games are like, it feels like some games are, I've said this multiple times, speaking of repeating myself like I did in the pre-show, some games definitely feel more like they are closer to software than they are art.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, for sure.
They're intentionally like, oh, this is much closer to, Microsoft Excel. than it is like the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing where you can have that where it's like it doesn't exist quite in the same way in other mediums where it's like, I don't know, strictly like, because play is so different. The interactivity makes things so different that that it can't just be one thing. But we have one word for these hugely varied things.
Yeah. Yeah. I was telling someone the other day that a lot of times when like I show someone my games, one thing that they might say is, oh, that's awesome. That's going to look great on your portfolio when you apply to jobs. And
yeah,
it's like, that's not why I made it or why I showed it to you.
Right. Because it's like, it's like, oh, well, that's not like a real game. That proves that you can make games.
Yeah.
But like, when do I win, you know? When does my dad meter go up when I say the right things? So that I'm so they know that I'm good.
Yeah. My game doesn't have enough combat.
No, not enough points and things going up. And listen, I like plenty of games where you have points and things go up. That's the variety of life that exists in all mediums, you know?
Yeah.
It's why I can watch, my Dinner with Andre one night and then the next night laugh at a clip from Roger Corman's The Raven posted in our Discord and thinking, wow, what a movie. We should watch that again.
Yeah.
The Raven is quite a movie. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend.
Gotcha.
It's not really... Anyway, we're not going to talk about weird old wizards. But that is besides the point. Actually, speaking of things that are besides the point, we're actually speaking of how fast these things tend to breeze by. We are approaching the end of our time here, actually, of our segment. But before we go, I have two important questions that are kind of like, you know, the two Indiepocalypse questions that come every week from repeat guests. And they are, yes, thank you, timer. Please stop shaking at me. I know I am over. What's your favorite type of rock?
My favorite type of rock?
Yes.
Alternative rock?
Thank you. Perfect. And what is, do you have a favorite Toho character?
A favorite what character?
I'm going to take that as a Toho.
No, I have never played Toho.
Perfect. Thank you. That's the first one is not optional. I require an answer. But the second one, I do not require an answer. The answer is often, I don't know what that is, or I never played one.
That's a good question.
Which that itself is an answer to the question.
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you for being here. I hope you'll stick around for our group segment, but we're going to go on a break right now.
All right.
And we will see our next guest on the other half of 2 minutes and 25 seconds.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Bye for now.
Oh, okay.
Hello, and welcome back to the show. That was P.S. Elliott with Sadie. We are back here with our next guest, who you may know from their work, not in Indiepocalypse. Like I said, we're branching out, folks. We're getting all over the spectrum of the arts world. As I just email people or DM them, be like, you want to be on my show? And sometimes they say, sure, why not? Sometimes they just don't answer. But from Broken Pencil, Lost and Called Funland, Zach Kotzer. Zach, how you doing?
Hello. Welcome to my parlor.
Hello. You're a little late. I guess Dracula's always in season, but...
It's every day is Halloween, like that... Pale Little Bands once said many many moons ago.
Which band was that? Every day is...
That was Ministry, right?
Every day is Halloween. I don't know. What band was that? It was Ministry.
It was Ministry.
I was like, in my heart, whenever I hear Halloween, I'm like, it's probably a Misfits song. They love singing about Halloween.
They do have at least three songs that are just called Halloween between, you know, Misfits and Danzig and Samhain.
But this is not them. Oh, no. In 2019, the track was released in an acoustic version with help with Dave Navarro on acoustic guitar.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
That's just a little fun tidbit for you.
My neighbor once had a Halloween karaoke party, and I was like, let's sing songs about Halloween. And it's like, you know, between that and Bela Lugosi, the problem isn't so much that they're bad songs. The problem is that, like, those songs are 9 minutes long, and
yeah,
whoever put them the karaoke versions up on YouTube wasn't really putting them down for time.
No, you see, you don't like to do the full entire Vincent Price intro to Thriller every time?
I mean, I personally would. A friend of mine told me some very dangerous information, in that sort of the most popular karaoke spot in Toronto, Bar Plus, has a very extensive song catalog, and someone just, like, dropped the line to me. He's like, next time you end up there, just know that Frankie Teardrop by Suicide is, for whatever reason.
That's actually the song, the other song I was going to recommend is...
Yeah, just what is it, an 11, 12 minute long song where you're just kind of, like, heaving into a microphone about a guy who goes bonkers and kills his family.
Yeah, I accidentally gave myself the old Freaky Teardrop challenge one day.
Yeah, you went out at night and
unintentionally, I was like, you know, this band Suicide. I've probably heard one or two songs, but I haven't really listened to their album. So, like, driving back home from my friend's house at, like, midnight, and Frankie Teardrop comes on. I'm like, what is this thing?
To anyone who doesn't know the Frankie Teardrop Challenge, which was recently devised by recent Broken Pencil magazine contributor Tom Sharpling.
Yes, I was surprised when I saw that. I was like, hey, I know that guy.
Yeah, hey, I have many, many tendrils stretching into many beautiful places.
That's what I'm increasingly doing. I've had a weird thought for this. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, but I was just going to say that, like, before you finish that thought, Tom Sharpling's Frankie Teardrop Challenge is just to go out at night, you know, in a not quite desolate area, just like some spooky place at night, and just see how long you can listen to the song Frankie Teardrop by Suicide, and how long you can listen to the song till you get too scared.
And it is like, and I will say, driving along a New England highway, it was intense to experience in the middle of the night.
Are you in, like, the Boston, New England area, or, like, the more forested Maine-ish New England?
I'm kind of, like, in the more, slightly more forested, but southern Mass.
Mm.
I am in Massachusetts, or Taxachusetts, as they call it. You know what I'm saying? But I'm kind of in the Rhode Island area. That's why I go every month. I take a sabbatical from the show to go to Providence, which is
all right.
I'm a fan of Providence. I like it.
I've never been, but even the name sounds so pleasant.
It's like, what if Toronto was, like, a little chiller and you could park everywhere? That's Providence.
You could park everywhere.
Yeah, there's, like, the place I go every month, it's, like, full parking, like, tons. There's too much parking, you might say. And it's all free, too.
Free parking everywhere.
Yeah. Well, not everywhere. Why aren't we all... In a lot of places.
Why aren't we living in Providence right now, folks?
I think that often. I prefer to go there than to go to Boston. But
Boston's boring.
Exceptionally.
You're not going to get any Boston defense from me. I mean, oh, it's a historical town. Oh, it's so gorgeous and red brick. And yeah, whatever. What do we do here? What can we... Looking at all these nice historical old buildings and statues is fine and all, but like I can, that's like, you know, that's Ottawa too, and there's just dick all to do here.
Yeah, I did not know. I have not taken a time to do things. The last two times I was in Toronto, the last time I was there for basically one day, and then I had to leave.
But it was a good day, right, Andrew?
Yes, no,
a very
I
good
loved
day.
Canzine was a great event. Excited to go. I was like, let me just go there. And we've alluded to it before, but people are not familiar with the catalog I mentioned up front. What's it all about?
Well, Andrew, yes. Canzine is an annual festival of zines and independent publishing and comics and art and all sorts of stuff. We just came back last year as a festival. It's put on by the magazine Broken Pencil, which is a long, long running since 1995 publication that focuses primarily on zine and underground art culture.
I've got one within arm's reach of me.
Oh yeah, is it the newest issue?
Yes, it's issue 100.
That's right. We just hit our 100th issue with the theme of generations. So I thought it would be appropriate to kind of celebrate the very notion of zines as something to exist in physical form, be passed on down as a community and a culture. And on the cover is this interesting zine crew based out of Singapore who call themselves Holy Crap SG. And what's sort of unique about them is it's a family. it's the parents and their two kids, and they've just been like turning all their family heirlooms and sort of vacation souvenirs and bric-a-brac into these very decadent sort of zine, almost like readable sculpture kind of work.
Yeah.
And you can learn much more in the magazine, as well as many other wonderful, wonderful profiles of all sorts of artists and history. Tom Sharpling, who we alluded to before, the beloved host of The Best Show, wrote a very touching sort of eulogy for the recently passed Joe Matt.
Yeah, there's like, I highly, if you make zines, a great little, here's a little tip for all the zine makers out there. Submit to the Zine Awards every year, whether you think you're going to get it or not. You get a subscription to Broken Pencil.
Yeah, we make it worth your while. Like, yeah. if you come and table down a canzine, you're walking away with a subscription to Broken Pencil. You enter the Zine Awards, you're going to end up with a subscription to Broken Pencil. We acknowledge, like, how important it is. Like, I think people really discount the kind of service that publications, especially printed ones, bring.
Yeah.
As far as being generally untethered to the digital media environment, which is very, you know, easily made cynical and easily made kind of a negative feedback loop. Obviously, in just the last few weeks alone, people are finally sort of breaking out of the grind with more user-funded and subscription-based platforms or publications, which is all steps in the right direction. But at the end of the day, if people you know, if you really want to support this stuff, if you really want something to keep and read and distribute and share information and share art and learn, then it's hard to top a printed publication.
Yeah, because it's like even like it's very hard for, you know, a friend to come over and pick up a website off of my that I left lying around on my table, you know, because I don't really print out websites and leave them lying around on my table very often.
If we were just merely like a website, we could not make any sort of money, sustainable amount of income,
right,
to publish most of what is available in the magazine. These are not things that generate SEO or viral traffic, which obviously, like, we still have an uphill battle of, like, you know, merely marketing and proliferating readership. But having a sort of foundation of people willing to buy and subscribe to what you're doing makes that a lot easier. And that is true of online publications too. The traditions just aren't quite as entrenched, I think, with digital publications. But that could change, and I would like it to.
Yeah, because the problem I've run into as a reader often with kind of like this, the increasing number of like, hey, we start our own publication, which like they start their own publication, but then they need to survive, so they just write the same stuff that I already don't care about, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's the kind of stuff you need to write about to survive.
Yeah, well, that's why everything's just sort of turned into like a content mill, right? Because that's... And the larger the outfits, the larger the companies that pick this up, the less they kind of care about like creating any sort of readership relationship or identity in a publishing space. And the more they're just kind of like, we can skim off the lowest common denominator by just having them write about Spider-Man.
Yeah. Listen, I will always prefer a worker-owned content mill to a corporate content mill. But
I mean, the news coming out of the Jezebel closing is just that, like, part of why they closed and part of why they didn't find a new buyer is just, like, obviously there's an ad crunch right now, but the existing advertisers just, like, opted, like, well, yes, there's a lot of breaking news about, like, women's rights and abortion access, but we just think that's too big of a bummer to put an Amazon ceramics ad next to, so
yeah, right. Or it's like, oh, you know, we can just have an AI scrape Twitter and post the relevant tweets, you know.
And I mean, it's funny to think that the publishing environment is such that you now there are people attempting to make robot generated content to be consumed by a robot generated search algorithm.
Yeah.
To the point that there's like not even people involved in this transaction anymore. It's just robots writing for other robots, which I don't think is.
Yeah, no, it feels like
you, it does. It feels like mulch. It doesn't feel very useful to anybody.
Unless you know how to use search engines properly, it feels like you will constantly stumble upon websites that are not designed for humans to use.
So if you know. If you want this stuff to get better instead of worse, and you have the means to, obviously, where you can, you gotta, you know, get involved to a certain extent, and then your involvement can be, you know, however much a month you can provide. At Broken Pencil, we have a pretty lean subscription base, so we are not an expensive magazine. We keep our overhead down as much as we can, even though, you know, costs, I'm sure, as you're encountering, are getting pretty expensive across the board.
Yes, yeah.
But we're not a decadent publication. We keep the costs down. Not that there's anything wrong with decadent publications. It's just, you know, it's for a different crowd, and I would know because
you have to find where your sustainability is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm also with Lost and Cult, and our products and books and journals there are much more decadent. We have, you know, very high quality printing materials and very delicious design sensibilities, but it's a different kind of book, and it's a great kind of book. But I think both, the existence of both, is what's required in a more balanced and healthy publishing ecosystem.
Yeah,
it does feel like print publications are having something of a moment, because I think, you know, we're constantly waiting to see if there's going to be like a paradigm shift, because it's clear the current trajectory of publishing is just going to collapse and get worse. So either there is a paradigm shift or it just gets worse. And you have to wonder, it's like, how many people will accept things just getting worse? I think we're in a culture of, you know, once upon a time, there was like the upper crust of society felt it was very noble of themselves to put all their money into
patronage, certain, you might say.
Yeah, patronage and certain publications, and that's why, you know, there's still so many publications out there called the Review or the Gazette of some sort, is because 60 years ago, some dude out in the Hamptons was just like, I'm gonna just, you know, put all this money into a fucking trust. Unfortunately now, as you might have noticed, the new rich doesn't really like journalism and writing too much.
No.
And are very openly antagonistic. I'm not saying that there's any altruism in the old upper crust. I'm just saying it was a different climate that was more hospitable to publishing.
Their tastes align more with what you want out of them.
Yes. And now we just have a kind of rich psycho mutants who want to build... If they can't build the world they think they should exist, they at least want to build a very flattering facade.
Yeah. Now, like the story of independent art is always completely intertwined with like your rich friend who has the space you can borrow for your band to play in. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's no getting rid of like, you know, money laundering in the art world at the end of the day. Less so than the independent art scene for the most part, but you know, money comes from somewhere, folks.
Yes.
And either it can come from you when it's possible, or it comes from worse people. And I know which one I would prefer.
Right. I'd rather, you know, 1,000 people than one person, always.
I will say this, Broken Pencil is definitely not a publication where any, you know, Saudi crown billionaires are hiding their fortune. We would have a much higher page count if that was the case.
That is until you get bought by somebody that.
Yeah, if we get bought by like Embracer Group or something.
The specter of being purchased, that thing that can just happen to you, of course, not a thing you decide to do.
Yeah, I my gut feeling is I wouldn't anticipate that for Broken Pencil.
No, of course ever, not.
Or anytime soon or ever. I don't know, you know, if certainly high society knows of magazines and newspapers, but, you know, if you write the word zine for them, they're going to say zine.
Yes.
You know, they're going to say.
Plenty of people who like zines say the word zine.
Yeah, but they're not, their eyes are just going to fog over, and
yeah,
there ain't no money to be. You're not gonna make a fortune in signs.
No.
Maybe you can make a living. Maybe you can make a living, but don't expect a fortune.
I think my original pitch for this project was like, listen, nobody is gonna get rich, but maybe it'll help some people be not in poverty. That was my grand ambition.
Yeah.
Was
yes.
Not poverty.
And I do think, you know, zines and independent publishing is certainly having a moment because, again, people want out of this Ouroboros that's been created by digital publishing. People want out. They want an off ramp to all of this because
the fatigue, you know, is setting in. Like,
we can only read about like, does this Marvel movie allude to a Spider-Man villain so many times? I don't know what's happened to my fucking Facebook feed, but it is just like packed with being suggested to like follow like Marvel movie meme groups, and I like try like tell them to stop each and every time, but it's like a Hydra situation. I just like cut off one head and then there's like 18 more Marvel news and meme groups that I just cannot I never even post about this shit.
It doesn't matter, it's all there is.
It seems so, like, because I wrote some pieces for Newsarama back in, like, 2009, it's just, like, Facebook's like, he likes comic books from now on. Is Facebook just, like, that one cousin you saw at a bar mitzvah when you were, like, 11, and now whenever you see them as an adult, they just say, oh, you're the one who likes Japanese animation. Is that just my imprint?
Yes, that is.
For the rest of my life?
Well, if... That's what happens when you have an anime-themed bar mitzvah, I guess.
I wish I had it. I'm sure that's happening now, too. The themed bar mitzvahs were pretty sparse back then, but I'm sure in, you know, the social media environment, so many parents must want, you know, a themed bar mitzvah. And I'm sure a lot of the kids, due to their cultural diets now, there's certainly a lot more Demon Slayer bar mitzvahs now.
than there were
Inuyasha themed bar mitzvahs when I grew up.
I That would be quite the experience, honestly. And
Andrew, what's the anime theme for your bar mitzvah?
Well, I had some clues leading in to referring to New England and where I grew up. Not Jewish. I would not have
bar mitzvah. That's not the point of this.
So I can have
yeah, you Andrew, you get to have an anime theme bar mitzvah. All you have to do is choose the anime theme.
Oh my god, what is my anime theme bar mitzvah? I don't know. I don't.
You can go with an anime you like. Now you can go to it. You can be less anachronistic and choose an anime you were into at 12.
Right. I'm trying to think, did I know what anime was when I was 12? I don't know if we had anime when I was 12. I think that was, once again, showing my age. that was the realm of people with fancier cable packages than I.
In Canada, YTV had already been playing. Like, when I was in junior high, YTV, which is like, I guess, our version of Nickelodeon or whatever, was definitely like, seen Wikipedias in the past, so like it was sort of known for playing slightly more mature programming than most like family stations were, so like it played like Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the 90s and got an early start with like Gundam Wing,
right? So in, right, like, the early 2000s. That's the thing about non-US channels, is like you just get a weird mishmash of all of our channels.
Well, especially when you talk to like people from like abroad, and they're like, "Yeah, what TV did you watch growing up?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, I had a weird like semi-pirated dub of like Lupin the Third and Macross."
Yeah, no, we had, you know, I think anime came around with Cartoon Network, and Cartoon Network didn't join like whatever the, you know, that affordable level of cable package. Until a while, I remember those exciting weekends. It's like, folks don't know about cable package sample weekends, you know, where it's like this. I don't know if you had those in Canada,
but sometimes... we had a kind of satellite TV channel explosion moment in the late 90s where like there was just this sudden boom in niche channels that were part of a package, so like the Drive-In Channel, and Book TV, most of which did not last more than like a couple of years. But things like Teletoon and the Space Channel hung around, and I worked for the Space Channel for a year.
Well, I will say here there was like, to my memory, there were like three spheres. There was free cable, which is like the three-letter alphabet channels, your NBC, ABC, CBS. And then the one you paid for, which had like Fox and maybe Nickelodeon or something. And then the third tier had all the exciting stuff like Cartoon Network and all these other things that eventually became roped in, but occasionally we get them. So what I'm saying is my reading from the Torah would be the Adult Swim bumpers. I would have had those memorized and I would read all of those.
Out of the pool.
Hey, that's, tonight was weird. That's where I learned about Daft Punk.
And I learned about Daft Punk from like a day camp in the summer, which had like an animation workshop program where we kind of like did South Park style construction paper stop motion. And the oldest kid in the group I was like assigned to like wanted made Around the World, the song that played in our like little animation of Cartman fighting the what's the name of the demon from Doom with like a machine gun for an arm? The Hell Lord.
Is it the Hell Knight? Is it the Hell Knight? I think it's the Hell Knight. No, the Hell Knight has a sword. Hell Knight Doom. What do you?
It's a race.
Is it?
No, it's not the Hell. No.
No. I know what you're talking about, though.
Yeah.
The Hell Knight's like a scarier dude. He's got like, he's like the little horse guy.
Yeah. It's not the horse guy. He's specifically Anyways, you know what I'm talking about. Anyways,
I know. We know what you're talking about. Look up Doom monsters. Yeah. You know what they are.
You dorks know. You dorks already know. We don't have to be too specific.
We know it's not a cacodemon. We know it's not a pinky. We know it's not an imp. It's the other one. If I keep naming.
But imagine that creature, you know, killing Kenny, and that's how I spent my summer as an 8-year-old was helping to the sound of "Around the World" by Daft Punk, and that was that summer.
Is it a cyber demon?
Oh, maybe.
It's the cyber demon.
There we go. There's perfect. The sauce.
We found him. It's the cyber
demon. Yeah, because the cyber demon's still got, like, hoofs and stuff, but he's a little bit more messed up. He's got a gun arm. He's got a gun arm, a robot leg, and something happened to that torso. I don't know what, but there was an incident.
His flesh is out there. Anyway, that's also where I bought Morrowind because of... I learned about Antunami, and that's, I think, where I might have heard the White Stripes for the first time.
Really?
Because they played Fell in Love with a Girl, because it was made out of Lego, so it was technically animation. But that said, Zach, the thing, like last time, the thing is now buzzing at me, and it's letting me know. Well, it's not buzzing because I can't hear it, but we are approaching...
So speaking of music, it's time to play some cool tunes.
In a second, but I have two questions for you first.
Okay.
What is your favorite type of rock?
I mean, if I have to choose one that I go back to, I guess I could just say garage is the one I retreat to the most.
Yes. A beautifully vague genre, but you know it when you hear it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And do you have a favorite Toho character?
Do you mean like the movie?
No, I mean the
studio.
The long running bullet hell franchise.
Oh no!
But if you have a movie character that off the top of your head, I'll accept that.
I mean, I was just gonna say like I have to go down their very extensive list of catalogs, but they do the Godzilla movies, so I guess I have a Hedora mask. I've always liked Hedora.
Always
a strong look on Hedora.
I really like while we're talking kaiju. I forget his name. I always forget his name. I like the guy with hooks for hands. He's a cool guy.
Is it Megalon?
No, Megalon's more like a turtle.
Yeah. No, Megalon's like a bug.
Is he a bug?
The drill hands. Yes. I know the one you're talking about. It starts with an R, right?
Maybe.
Gigan. No, it's Gigan.
Yeah,
like
he's a cool guy.
The visor. Yeah. He's a cool guy.
He's got hooks for hands.
Must be hard to scratch his ass, but
I don't know. I don't know what his deal is. I've seen two Godzilla movies. I've seen Godzilla, and I've seen Destroy All Monsters. Two ends of the spectrum.
I like that Gigan has like a saw blade sticking out of its chest, and you know, don't think about that too hard.
No, he's got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. It's just one of those monsters that are like, I don't know, cobble a couple of the props together and see what pops out.
Truly beautiful, a beautiful medium.
Those 80s and 90s Godzilla monsters get so like elaborate and almost like more anime influence, where they just have like, you know, crystal shoulders and you know, like they're going Super Saiyan at a certain point.
Yeah, they're full on. Like, these are not serious movies that have ideas anymore. This is professional wrestling in rubber suits.
Yeah, and that rules. I mean, that's not to dismiss them. It's
no different things. Different things.
I would rather watch that than like the what's his name Gareth, the first of the American reboot Godzillas, which is like. Has the aesthetic of something with pretense, but doesn't really have much to say beyond, like, Fukushima, what a bummer. Anyways, here's some aliens.
Yeah. Aliens are slightly less of a bummer. Speaking of no bummers, we're going to our next break. Zach, thanks for being here on the show with me.
No problemo.
We're going to go on break and be back in about 2 minutes and 52 seconds. Bye for now. Hello, welcome back to Indiepocalypse Radio. We're just We're back from the break with the whole crew talking about the important things about Tim's and Dunkin's.
Yeah, can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
Dunkin' sucks.
I have no despite being a lifelong Massachusettser, I have no allegiance to Dunkin' Donuts in the slightest.
Awful. Awful, awful. And I'm not saying, like, Tim's is the best donut in the world. It's certainly not the best coffee or anything, but...
Oh, I don't even like coffee. That's part of it.
Well, God almighty, the donuts at Tim's are such a higher quality than the stuff you settle for at Dunkin's.
Yeah, we are back here with Zach and the team are both here. We're yelling in the meantime. Getting to the thing that I care about the most, food.
It's timely. Finally time to talk about food.
It's part
team,
of...
Do you have any skin in this game? What do you think? Dunkin's, yay or nay?
I think they're both bad.
You think Dunkin's and Tim are both bad?
Yeah. I don't really care for donuts. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
No, and I didn't even have a donut. I had a breakfast sandwich.
And at Tim's.
Yes, and I was like, perfectly fine.
Yeah, their sandwiches are fine.
And I went to...
Convention food. You eat them at conventions.
And I made a trip to Smokes.
Oh, the poutinerie.
Yes, because that's the thing when I travel is because it's like, I'm sure there are plenty of like, here's a really good Thai restaurant you can get in Toronto. But I'm like, I can get a good Thai restaurant. There's those in the United States too.
But the Thai in Toronto is very good.
But I have one that's like...
It's good. It's the food in Toronto is so good.
I have one that's like right down the street from me.
And I have like a little like Thai home kitchen around the corner. And if you follow me on Twitter, you know, I'm sorry. When they do their barbecue chicken lunch special, I'm going to celebrate.
Yeah.
I'm going to celebrate it. It is a special occasion.
But I have to go get the thing that I can't get within the United States. So I the first night when I went to go get my toothpaste, I picked up all dress chips because those are the
Don't treat the food in Toronto like I treat traveling through the States where I'm like at a Publix and say like, "What a bizarre soda. I should pick that up." You can't just I don't know. Our local cuisine can't be reduced to just that.
I think if I had like a longer stay, if I had like a good, like, and it wasn't something I did once, say every 3 to 4 years.
next time, resist the urge to settle on Putin.
Yeah,
and
I think
I don't know. Go to Chinatown or Baldwin Village or...
I did get a good chicken sandwich on my way back from... It was somebody's name. Was it Penny's? Is that a chicken sandwich place?
Was it like on Spadina?
I believe so,
in Chinatown, yeah.
It was in a small little venue with three other restaurants.
It almost sounds more like a Kensington kind of thing, but...
I think it was on that main street that I was like, oh, this main street sucks. I hate this.
Kensington? Is that in Canada?
Yeah.
In Toronto, there's a Kensington market.
I live in Kensington in New York.
In Kensington market, it's like this little bohemia town of Toronto. They pride themselves on not having like chain restaurants in there.
It was.
Lots of local chains.
Yes, but that's I like local chains are fine. You know, I enjoy a good like 2 to 3 restaurant chain is like ideal.
Yeah, there's no Starbucks in Kensington, but there's definitely like a Big Fat Burrito and Otto's Donair.
Oh, that's what I should have. I had a whole Game in the Apocalypse about Donairs, and I didn't have a. But that was very specifically about a specific type of donair. I think it was in like.
Have you ever been to like the Maritimes, Canada, like the East Coast? Because they're very proud of their donair.
What it was about. It was about like that Maritime area donair.
Yeah, it's always the places you don't expect to like be very proud of their like donair poutine hybrids or pizzas or whatever. When I was staying in Rotterdam, they had like Donair fries, and they're like, this is a local delicacy. It's like, well, you just kind of put a bunch of tasty stuff on top of fries, but I'll take it. I'm wasted. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
We can do this. Yeah.
They had also that same, this is Fring Frang I'm talking about. I'm trying to find the name of the game. Because they had also done a game about, was it like story or language over in like the Nova Scotia area?
Oh, this is definitely ringing a bell. I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
But is it clairvoyance? Maybe? Clairvoyance is related to folklore, I don't think. And that's Claire, like Claire, Nova Scotia. But I don't think that was the game. It was another game that was like very much like, hey, here's like local language kind of stuff, I believe. I thought it was them.
Yeah, Fring Frang. Donair Academy.
Yes, that was the game, but they also made another, or someone in there worked on a game that was related to was it Henry Adams Spec? Anyway, we're getting in the weeds of looking up things. I hit a button that freaked out my mouse, and I forget which one it is to unfreak it.
You mean your computer mouse? Because that does make sense. If it was a pet rodent of some sort.
No mice down here. Occasionally, a good mouse head lying around, as we have mousers.
Lovely.
Yeah, you need a good mouser, you know, if you live near woods. I found my button. I found the button on my gamer mouse that calms down my sensitivity.
It's definitely a mouse that's like hiding underneath my barbecue from all the neighborhood cats.
Oh yeah, no, we've got one that ate a lot and then sometimes throws it up. Gets sick, he eats too much of the mouse.
It's like, oh, the mouse. I see.
Yeah. Finger, no, it's the mouse. Like I said, we have like a good, like a, I think a good cat Leo is one that's lazy, living the Garfield life, and one that is a true mouser. we just inherit neighborhood cats.
For a second, I thought I was about to get my second mistaken Uber Eats delivery of the week.
That would be a true treat. I once got a 5-pound bag of gummies that I did not order.
Last time it was earlier in the week. It was just a kale salad, but you know.
Yeah,
I didn't pay for it.
I also imagine it happens more often if you live in a city. It's a lot harder to accidentally deliver to a house that has trees between all of its neighbors.
Probably.
It's like, oh, it's a lot hard to accidentally find your way there, but if you can accidentally get a bag of gummies, that's...
Just a bag of regular gummies?
I think there might have been gummy worms.
Still, that's, imagine having such a gummy worm craving that you, like, had it delivered, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know who it was. If it was a prank, no one has ever admitted to it in the decade since it happened. So I don't know what it is, but mild tangent. Speaking of cats, when I was in Toronto, I kept thinking I was seeing cats out of the corner of my eye constantly, but it was those squirrels.
Oh, our darker squirrels are throwing you off.
Dark fur squirrels, because I'm not used to seeing. So like, is that, I'm like a cat, and my cat instincts went off. You know, like, oh no, it's a squirrel.
I'm gonna head off for just a second. I'll be right back.
Yes. But anyway, team, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Now, have you done any like smaller like zine fairs or like festivals with like comics or any other kinds of art?
No. So I'm from Morocco. There isn't much of a comic scene there, neither. There isn't an indie game scene either. So definitely nothing on the local scale. I've moved here to New York very recently for my master's. But yeah, I'm definitely trying to get more into it. I made my first zine this year.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. I usually just put comics on Instagram.
Right. In the global market or the global zine festival.
Yeah.
But that is, yeah, there is something, I highly recommend it. There's something about, like, and this is a personal thing where I have difficulty extracting meaning out of likes, even if it was like 1,000 of them. compared to like, a person you can see in space that likes something.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
I was saying it's hard for me to find meaning in like a number next to it, like a picture of a heart, you know, a number of likes compared to like a one person in person that likes it.
Yeah, for sure. What was I gonna say? Oh, the first thing is that I pronounced them as Zine, so I'm glad that you guys corrected me on that.
And the thing is, it doesn't really matter too much.
I've been to like a couple indie comics shops here where people can just like put their zines on comics there to sell. Anyone can do that.
Yeah, so, that's like the cool. It's good that you have those, because I was thinking, I was like, oh, you know, I wonder if like New York is like, it's just like more generally more expensive. So I wonder if all these events are also like expensive.
Because
I remember there's that game event that happens in there in New York. It's like super expensive.
Have you been to New York?
Yes, twice.
Have you like interacted with the indie game community here?
I don't think so, really. Like,
so there is a place called Wonderville.
Yeah,
it's a bar where they have like a lot of workshops and gaming events. I don't know if you're ever interested in trying to sell the tips somewhere. I feel like they'd be down to have those over there.
Yeah, I definitely want to travel more. But also, you know, it's expensive to travel, and New York is like very expensive.
Yeah.
So there are some places where like when I was doing more traveling for games, it'd be like I would go to some places where the event plus the hotel plus my food plus everything all together would be like the cost of my hotel in New York, and that hotel would also be a closet.
Yeah.
So
you're in Boston?
No, I'm in a undisclosed town.
Okay.
Massachusetts.
Is there an indie gaming scene in Massachusetts?
There is a long running meetup group in Boston that's been around for like quite a while. And that's like one central one, but there's also like a couple of like specialized ones. Like there's one for Unity, one for like audio stuff.
Oh.
There's a whole bunch of them. If you're like in the city, I imagine you can keep yourself busy going to them. I usually go to.
Let me see.
I usually go to the one meetup, like every 4 months when they do like a demo night, because it's also like over an hour for me to drive there, so it's hard to like drive an hour to see a talk and then drive home.
Yeah.
if I'm going out, especially because they have them in the middle of the week, so it's like a work day then tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it's not like I can be out all night and get home at like 2 o'clock, because I'd have to then go to work at like 6 o'clock, which is not ideal.
I imagine.
But now there is like, yeah, there's a lot. I think that there's a lot of good local scenes, and I think it's important to like go to them more than even focusing on like, oh, I gotta get big online.
Yeah, for sure, 100%. Because it's such a lonely process, like making games on your own.
Yeah.
See, like you need people around you to that. Also do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you need to like, I think it's helpful to like develop like a local scene and like a local vibe, you know.
Yeah.
And like play off of each other. Because I think that's how you get more interesting stuff that way, I think.
Yeah.
Because if you're just, like, playing off the internet, unless you have, like, an online community, there's a good chance you're just kind of, like... I think that's how you get so many games are just, like, playing off of what popular games are, you know?
Yeah.
Because those are the games that you see.
But when
But you're able to, like, hey, actually, like, sit down and play a lot of stuff that, like, is that kind of, like, itch scale sort of independent stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's also,
yeah, go ahead.
Like, when it comes to an online community, you, like, you don't know what kind of people play your games. Like, if they don't like it, you don't know if it's because, just because it's just, like, not what they're into.
Yeah.
You don't know whose feedback to take.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's the weird thing where, I think you run into where it's like, well, they can have, you know, we can have everything. You tend to be picky or whatever, but like, I think like having a local scene is like almost a way of like curation in a way, sort of.
Because
it's like, instead of having all of games or even just all of itch to look at, it's like, oh no, I have the people who are here, and that's the people, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's hard to things like feedback and that sort of thing is especially, I think, difficult for online because you really don't know someone. Like I think someone has to, like, really, you know, reviewing is a skill. And I think it's very, like, you can't get that off of someone saying, oh, I think the jumping feels weird. Like, even I've showed off, like, some Indiepocalypse games at events and people would be like, oh, you open for feedback? And I'm always like, no, because I didn't make the games and they're done. But also, but sometimes people will give, like, feedback. I'm like, oh no, this, that, like, no, the game, the thing you're complaining about, like, the game is made intentionally like that. I think game feedback is tricky because if you don't know who you're talking to, I think a lot of it is, especially, is like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like incurious. They're looking for, like, they're not looking for rough edges or, like, complications or things that are, like, unfamiliar to them. So you get a lot of, I think a lot of the feedback kind of can lend itself towards being, trying to guide you towards being, like, what a quote unquote video game should be, you know?
Yeah. It's like user accessibility more than anything. Like, is your game polished?
Right, exactly. It's like,
is it in the fighting? Is it fun?
Yeah, is it? And a lot of it feels like, oh, I'm picking up this controller, and if I'm giving you feedback, it's because the game isn't doing everything I exactly expect it to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you have, like, good quirks to your gameplay, I think people sometimes see those as negatives and try to give them, you know, feedback for them. Like, oh no, it shouldn't do this. But I like abrasive art, you know, or like different art. Or, you know, I just, you know, games, I think games can encapsulate a much wider space than they're thought of currently, you know.
Or hear me out.
Okay.
Mario.
Yes.
Halo.
Okay, so the little
on mobile.
Oh, now we're talking.
Yeah.
Give me a battle pass and we're in.
Together at last.
Yes. The true nuts and gum of video games.
Nice.
I mentioned that I saw it recently earlier. But you know, having just watched my dinner with Andre. I'm like, this is a movie. You can just make this a movie, and people will say it's a good movie for decades. And it's just two guys in a restaurant talking.
Yeah.
And, like, I think with time you'll get there where, like, the video game equivalent of that will all, you'll also have respect for just things that are just, like, so far afield of, like, what mainstream video games are, and people go, oh no, these are like classical video games, they're canonical video games. But
what do you think is the My Dinner with Andre of video games? Was it that
there was the My Dinner with Andre arcade game from The Simpsons?
Yes. Bon Mott and Tell Me More.
Trenchant Insight.
What was the name of that, like, from decades ago, that, like, conversation simulator where you walked into a couple's apartment?
Oh, and... I don't know. I never remember the
name. Facade?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Facade is, like, it is one of those, like, the closest things that are, like, it's a true mess in a lot of ways. And I think it feels like one of those things where what people took out it is further from the intention of the game, because what did those people didn't those people go on to do weirder, like military stuff or something?
yeah they did.
Yeah, there was some trajectory for, like, oh okay, so these were not like, like, maybe they were coming to it more from the AI portion than, like, the art side.
It's the ultimate goal of any game designer.
Yeah. I can't wait to work for the military one day. But, yeah, no, that is, you know... There are tons of games that, like... There are games that exist in that space still that have, like, you know... You know, they're, and part of, if I had more time and more money, I would love to just, like, really get real deep dive stuff of, like, of these old art games, you know, and, like, you preserve them. I would love to, you know, fill them full of interviews and things like that, and commentaries, and, like, because I think this is part of, like, what you were talking about, Zach, with, like, it's important to have a physical, like, it's good to have physical things, like, making something, like, a product, and, like, especially even more so, like, a physical thing, creates, like, a different, like, mental space within, like, art, you know, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
Well, like, it's, like, it just accomplishes a lot, because even if preservation isn't, like, the most important thing, it's one of those. It comes with the package.
Yeah. But, it's like
you want something to be a slow read, you get that too. It's it creates a different and necessary environment than digital publishing, and not just to, like, be a luddite about it, but it's very clear that digital publishing is not exactly beneficial to readers, to the publishers, or to the world.
Right. And, like, there's,
while the traditional publishing systems are far from perfect either, we're a lot closer to something stable and amicable to all parties involved there than just letting these sort of gatekeeping tech companies further dwindle whatever agency and opportunity there is online.
Yeah, I was talking to a contributor of the zine, Lentilian in Toronto, about how, like, there ought to just be a box that you can plug a USB stick into that launches games.
Well, it was called the Ouya, and you all fucked up. Listen,
Ouya fucked themselves up. I give me enough money, and I'm going to make Ouya. I mean, eventually, that's my brain. I'm like, what if I made Ouya 2?
Right
this time.
And you put your killer app, Mario Halo.
No, my killer app is, like, Echo Knight or whatever. My killer app is some old PS1 game that is, like, $800 now.
But, yeah, you see a lot of dorks who are like, oh, why isn't there a Criterion for games? It's like, because it'd be pointless. Because, like, you know, what, are they going to make these games for every platform?
Right.
It'd be boring. If it's like the games that need the true service that like a group like Criterion provides is not exactly going to be commercially viable gaming.
No, you do it. You do what they did, and you start off with like some Japanese heavy hitters. Whatever the Akira Kurosawa equivalent is, in video games.
Do not put a second mortgage on your house if your business goal is to remaster and re-release the Gayblade because it's unavailable. Even it'd be an altruistic thing to do, but like Criterion can make money because they have access to like heavy hitting, revered works of cinema, and also as a service, kind of like restore and give greater access to more difficult films. That's not going to happen for games.
There's definitely like that. There's also the culture of, like you mentioned, those patron style. Like, there's people who are like, oh yeah, there's universities and all sorts of like a lot of those prints start with saying, with help from such and such university with restoration and all that kind of thing. Like it's not like a purely a commercial where they're just like licensing something and putting it on a Blu-ray.
So many films were created as a product.
Yeah.
Games were especially created as a product, and yes, trying to smush that into the same framework is going to be needlessly a headache. So while I think there is good to be done in like preserving, restoring, and saving difficult to access video games, I don't think the sort of existing frameworks for other mediums is very helpful.
No, there's a different avenue for it, it's funny you say that, because the first couple things I had, like if I ever did kind of like try to figure, because I have tried to figure out like what is the format for that style of thing, you know, how do you present it, how do you make it work and everything, and Gayblade and Caper and the Castro were two of the first games I would think about if I would include.
Well, yeah, like all those like early 90s, late 80s underground queer games are just sort of like, in my mind, the perfect candidates for such a treatment. But again, like, easier said than done for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, and there's the big difference where it's like, they do exist on the Internet Archive. I could go get them right now, but there's a cultural like change if somebody was like, could go to like a website and purchase a copy of it, you know, and they would get like a physical thing. There's like, it changes, I think, how people think about these sort of things in a weird way.
Yeah. That Atari anniversary thing from last year was pretty great. And I think that's a pretty good and interesting framework as far as the game goes, like what could be possible, but it also simultaneously like feels limiting too, because like, yeah, this is great, but it almost kind of only works because it is Atari, right? And it is such a familiar brand and history for people that
like the Prince of Persia one they did following that works.
The Karateka,
Karateka,
which I can't imagine was a huge seller, but you know, good on them for going at it.
Yeah. I was thinking Prince of Persia just because of Jordan Mechner, but that he also
it's the same fella, yeah.
Because he has so many logs of all of his stuff, you know, like he has so much journals and like all these different things, and also it was a massive hit. But yeah, that is you're touching it on my pipe dreams of like I want to figure this out, like.
Well, it is a conundrum because you have it's so tempting to go into these kind of like cultural shorthands.
Yeah, because
there's so many effective establishments for other mediums that do this.
But you need to find the way that works.
Yeah, but with gaming, the complication is like it's more technically exhausting.
Yes,
it's more financially exhausting, and you know, to really really put a big kiss on it. It probably wouldn't make nearly as much money either.
The space I've been working in for like the past for almost 4 years now, you know, is, I would say, not lucrative. I think I said even last week how negative I was on this whole venture, which is
the next issue of the sorry.
No, go ahead.
The next issue of Broken Pencil is definitely going to touch on the fact that, like, you know, 10 years ago, it felt like there was a moment where the internet was going to work out good for independent artists and creator.
Yeah.
And then it just seemed to, like, slip through our fingers.
Yes, no, it is.
And it went away and it never came back.
I think that's part of why I've just, like, mostly stopped using every online site, because I just don't think I don't think that's the answer. I don't think being on Twitter and Blue Sky and Mastodon and Co-host and Instagram and Facebook and Threads, I don't think being active on those is actually the long-term answer.
Yeah, I remember it because I got paid by them, but Tumblr very briefly set up, like, an in-house publication called Storyboard.
Yeah. Oh, it's like a way to, too.
Yeah. As, like, a way to, like, highlight all the stuff. But they, like, in almost circumstantially, like, hired award-winning journalists and, like, won a James Beard. The Tumblr in-house magazine won a James Beard Award for covering, like, restaurants during that, I think the... What was the big hurricane that, like, slammed into New York and New Jersey, like, 10 years ago? But anyways, they covered that, and they won an award for it. But it was, like, again, it was only circumstantial, the fact that, for a moment, Tumblr thought, like, this is how we can make it look obvious that, like, this is a good place for artists. But the moment that it became, like, financially incompatible, it's like, eh, never mind.
Yeah, that's... financial incompatibility is, like, the secret is, the indie apocalypse secret is, you just take it on the chin every month and realize that you're just going to be financially incompatible.
The more you remember that, you know, social media is no good for us and we're no good for them, but you keep using it anyways. As long as you remember that's the current relationship, that's the current dynamic, that's a better way to keep your feet planted on the ground.
Right. Think of it like posting, you know, you go to the bulletin board, you post, and then you leave. You don't sit there all day and hang out around your post.
It shouldn't be part of your, you know, business strategy to be like good at Twitter. I've worked for companies whose, like, business strategy is like having a large Facebook group, and I kept trying to flag it down. It's like, this is a terrible strategy. This is not a good way to run a business. It's just like leveraging yourself to investors is like having a lot of Facebook followers, because anything can happen on Facebook, and we have zero. Anything can happen on Google.
Yeah.
There are years where, like, the Google search algorithms, like, changed again. They usually don't change as often. It's like, well, now they are. So what are we going to do about it?
And
if we.
Yeah. And I say, you know, as an independent creator, I did more sales at Canzine than I did that month online, and I'll tell you which audience is bigger, it's online.
It's just about wondering, is a paradigm shift going to happen? Are younger audiences going to, you know, they clearly desire something else, but how far are they willing, will they be able to go for it?
Right.
Because I do feel like younger people would appreciate, you know, the more traditional mediums. It's just never really been available to them for one reason or another.
Right, right. But I think, you know, maybe, I wonder if there is, like, the people a generation above them are like, well, I want these spaces. So if they start to build out, like, the place I go to Providence is only like a year or two old, that event.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, as more of these, like, little markets and events crop up, and they'll be like, yeah, this is what I've been looking for, you know? Because it is a lot of young people who do go to those events, and they're like, it's what they crave, you know?
Yeah, because they want that off-ramp. They want an exit strategy to this, like, nightmare media consumption environment that's been That's just more pain than pleasure.
I've said it on the show. You're not meant to think about that many people at the same time. It's too many people to think about.
And they've all, again, you know, they've been reduced, like, right. as a financial value, they've been reduced by this environment. So it's like, it's just not good for humanity that, like, we've, business in general has been retinkered to the point, like, you know, it used to be, like, if you had 2,000 as an audience, that was good enough. And now it's like, well, you need, like, most of the global population to be paying attention to you at any given point if you want to be successful. It's like, well, that's not viable.
No, right.
who made this decision, right?
Right, because you're like, oh, well, of course, of those 2,000, only, like, 20 actually are active. Like, well, what are the other 8? What are the other 1,980 there for? And that is, yeah, it's
so that either breaks or it gets worse. And, you know, I'm not saying it will break. I'd say there will be a paradigm shift, but it's the only other option. We're seeing, you know, there are signs, right? There are signs. The proliferation of user-backed publications is a good and healthy thing. And I know lots of people have had sites and platforms that they've tried to leverage with Patreon in the past, and for one reason or another didn't work. It's not like I'm not dismissing those.
Right.
It's just clear that there's more a more concentrated effort to replace the dysfunctional publications with a functioning framework.
Yes. And hopefully it'll last a little longer, because I mean, mm-hmm. publications are always going to come and go.
Mm-hmm.
My publication will, I mean, I'm doggedly persistent, so it will probably just exist forever because I'm, I don't know. I just am very good at sticking to things.
Because you're a zinester, gosh darn it.
And I'm like, I'll just keep making, as long as there be people making games, I'll probably just be making this thing forever. And because I make it, now I'm making a full issue a month in advance after only 4 years. But, like, just making work in advance just makes me like, oh, well, I just keep on doing it because I'm obligated. But
I mean, like, when I first saw your name on, like, the sign-up sheet, I was like, I didn't know Andrew, like, sold things at zine fairs. And
yeah.
We had that. I was very interested to see what that looked like, and I was very, you know, pleasantly surprised with the results.
Yeah, I made 3 new zines just for Canzine.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm going to leave you guys. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, perfect. No, I was actually wrapping up soon anyway, so that is a perfect time. So as we wrap up, because we're cresting like an hour and a half, which is usually, you think it's, I have both of your tabs open. So like, that is my thing. Right? That's me ready to paste them into the chat. So Atim, thank you for being here. Thank you for making it. Yeah. Thank you for generally being around. Where can people find your work if they want to find it?
And they should. I'm HatimB00 on Twitter, Tumblr, itch.io, and Instagram.
Perfect. So check
and
that.
Yes, that's me. Yeah.
And Zach, where would you want to, what kind of place would people want to find your work?
Well, you can find, I'm the editor-in-chief of Broken Pencil magazine, and it's been around for a while, so simply Googling that should yield all right. If you want to follow me personally, it's Zach Kotzer on Twitter with 3 A's and 3 O's. So it's
perfect.
K-O-T, yeah, K-O-T-Z-E-R, but there's 3 O's.
Yes.
I like to be distinctive. If you think that's obnoxious, like, I just have a bad habit of creating Gmail accounts with really long addresses, and whenever I'm like asked to like write it down in person, it's humiliating. But yeah. I do it every time.
I have humiliating Gmail addresses. I think I'm just from a different generation. That my Gmail address is not just my name, plus my birth year or whatever, which seems like a lot of people do.
Now, my original one was my original, like, high school newspaper pen name, which was King Frankenstein, and I
yeah.
kept Whoa. That around. Yeah, I know. And the saddest part is, if I made a King Wolfman, I might have stuck with it.
It's just, it's a different generation where you don't use your real name, you know? Well, perfect. I will say, Indiepocalypse, you know where to find it. You find it at indiepocalypse.com. You submit your games at indiepocalypse.com/submit. Those tapes that I've talked about throughout the show, you can get those at indiepocalypse.com/tapes. You can join the Patreon, indiepocalypse.com/Patreon. Either get it weekly or get it monthly. There's a bargain on, sign up for a year, save 2 months. You can just get for, I think, about 50 of your American dollars, you can get a full year of only the commissioned games, which is like, 12 brand new funded games by Indiepocalypse. And your support helps to not keep Indiepocalypse alive. I guess it does, sort of, but this thing was budgeted so that it would survive in the face of extreme indifference, but it does help give people more closer to what they should be getting paid, is how I like to think about it. The rates that they should be getting, to be included. That's all. Zach, thank you both for being here. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm trying to do this more. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for tuning in either now or later. I have, I've said on the show, a very complicated relationship with audiences where I feel like acknowledging them and being nice to them is manipulative.
How dare you?
Because it means
treat them like the filth and the scum that they are. Treat them like the little piggies.
Yeah, it's like gratitude. It's just like, what is the line between gratitude and trying to develop a parasocial relationship for the means of commercial extraction? I'm trying to find that line, but I am like, this is. I still think about the people who have gone up to like events and like, I love this thing and I like it, and because I love this thing, I love making it, even if it hates me sometimes and I hate it sometimes. That's the nature of art, though, baby. Anyway,
I love it. Art can't live with him, can't live without him.
Yes, a true monster. Anyway, we're closing it out. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.